Welcome back to In the Shadows of Utopia. This is Lachlan Peters, and I've got another very special bonus episode to share with you today. So, back in November of 2018, before I went to do an internship at the Documentation Centre of Cambodia, or DC Camp for short, I was able to set up an interview with my former undergrad thesis advisor, and one of the foremost experts on Cambodian history, Professor David Chandler. David is the author of many titles associated with both Cambodian history and the Khmer Rouge regime, titles such as Brother Number One, A Political Biography of Pol Pot, Voices from S21, The Tragedy of Cambodian History, as well as A History of Cambodia, which I've quoted on the podcast in recent episodes. He is currently retired, but in the past he taught at places such as Cornell, Johns Hopkins, as well as at Monash University in Melbourne, which is where I first met him in 2012. David recently received an award for distinguished contributions to Asian studies for his extensive scholarly work on Cambodia's history, politics, and culture. In this interview or discussion, we speak about David's career as an academic, his experience visiting the country soon after it opened up again in the 1980s. We talk about him testifying as an expert witness in the trial of former Khmer Rouge leaders, as well as his thoughts on the historical debate about whether the crimes of the regime can really be defined as genocide. It was a great pleasure to have this conversation with David. But I should mention that the interview itself is aimed primarily toward the historiography of the period, rather than an explanation of events that transpired. So it may not exactly be easy listening for those that are unfamiliar with the history itself, or the wider scholarly works that have been written about the subject. For those that are unfamiliar with the history of the period, you might find that this interview would be better revisited once the series itself is complete, but I do provide small bits of context throughout the interview, as small details require a little bit of explanation. Also, just a note on the audio itself, we were set up in his living room with just one mic, so please excuse that aspect of the interview, as well as, you know, the occasional tram you might hear going past in the background. Alright, so with all of that in mind, I give you Professor David Chandler. Alright, so in the introduction to the show, I will have given the audience an idea of how you've become considered one of the eminent historians of Cambodia and the Democratic Kampuchea regime. So I'd like to just jump right in, if that's okay, and begin our discussion in and around the time that the Khmer Rouge came to power. So as the civil war was coming to an end in Cambodia, and it became increasingly clear that what the outcome was going to be, can you explain what it was like watching these events unfold in early 75, and in particular what the 17th of April looked from your perspective?
Sure. I mean, I was at Monash University then. I had been for 3 years already. I was seeing what I could about what was happening up there. I hadn't really followed it very, very closely. I'd hoped that the Vietnam War would end sooner than it did, but it didn't. I didn't know anything about the Khmer Rouge as a movement. Nobody did at the time. I was surprised, of course, with the immediate response of the takeover. Everybody was, when the Khmer Rouge sent people out of the cities and started killing high-ranking members of the former regime and so on. All that's documented. That period is documented very nicely in the movie Killing Fields, which is quite an accurate depiction of that final period of Cambodian, of certain kind of Cambodian history.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I was glad. I mean, I think I was sort of sharing it with Cambodians without being too... I didn't concentrate on that. My writings were all about pre-colonial Cambodia. My thesis was pre-colonial Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
and I was writing articles, and such as they were, was about pre-colonial Cambodia at that period. I didn't write first. I wrote one piece in 76 about the Khmer Rouge a year after they took over. But basically, I didn't concentrate on it. Mm-hmm. I wasn't a contemporary historian. I was enjoying myself doing the stuff I was doing further back. Mm. And working on a history of Cambodia, thinking of doing that from Angkor, from where all of. So yeah, it was scary. It started to be scary. And the blackout was very scary. Mm. And then in 77, I had a sabbatical in the United States where I was in Massachusetts. And more and more news was coming in. We had Paul Scholes' book came out. And I sort of shifted away from a kind of can't tell attitude to this must be a pretty awful attitude, which is what I've stayed with ever since.
Yeah.
I have to say that didn't really happen much before 77 in terms of public statements of mine.
And when were you able to return to Cambodia?
Well, I wasn't able to return to Cambodia for research until 1990, but I had 71 and 70, 1970 to 1971, I'd done research for my thesis in Phnom Penh mm-hmm. on two-week stretches, which was fun. So I was allowed back in for that, and I could have stayed longer, but my family was in Bangkok, and I didn't want to stay longer. But in 81, following a conference in Chiang Mai sponsored by the Social Science Research Council in America, a conference on the Khmer Rouge that later led to a book called Revolution and Its Aftermath in Kampuchea, published at Yale Southeast Asia Program. That was when, in the backwash of that, thanks to Trinity Ben Kiernan, and who'd been to Cambodia before in the early 80s, or 80, the year before, and Michael Vickery had been there a year before, mm-hmm. Were allowed into Cambodia for a few days as a sort of a delegation, I guess. And we were spoken to and taken around and went to the museum and went to the archives and took photographs and so on. And it wasn't really Cambodia, and it was pretty depressing, but I was there for 3 days and didn't write it up. Then I didn't get back till 90 when the state of Cambodia was operating, and they allowed, Westerners in to do research. Mm. That was an interesting time.
That's when you begin writing sort of some of the books you're most famously associated with, like Brother Number One, The Tragedy of
The Tragedy book was, they were both in process at the time.
Okay.
The Tragedy book started in 87.
Okay.
By 90 that had been sent to the press. It came out in 91.
Yeah.
The Pol Pot book I was writing sort of in tandem, but it was due later. So I did pick up some information for the Pol Pot book in those visits in 1990 and again in 1991. Got nice, interesting data, so cabinet meetings and stuff, which is good, and some interviews. So the Tragedy of Cambodian History comes out in 91.
And then it's...
In the fall, that's right. That's when I was in Paris. Came out when I was in France on sabbatical again. The other book came out in 92, Brother Number One. Revised to 99 when after Pol Pot died. So mm-hmm. two additions to that.
And Voices from S21, was that
99.
99,
okay. Same as the second edition of Pol Pot, so of the Brother Number One book.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and for the Brother Number One book, I was excited. I did a lot of research in Canada, in Montreal. There are a lot of Cambodians up there. And down in California, I talked to a lot of Cambodian expats. And I did interviews in Cambodia itself and in France, a lot in France. Mm-hmm. It was a wonderful time banging around 86, 7, 8, 9.
Yeah.
Banging around those countries on 2-3 week stretches to do interviews. And that was terrific. But I really enjoyed that. And I think those interviews have held up because they were quite, 86, 7, 8 is only 10 years after the Khmer Rouge, if that's what you want to talk about. But also it was people who could still, this was 32 years ago, who could still remember not only the scenic era, but before that, who could remember the 40s and 50s in Cambodia. Very interesting people I spoke to. So that was enabled me to write a a political history of that, of the post-war period of Cambodia, which nobody had done before. It just happened not to have done before.
Yeah.
And I was very happy with that, with the interviews that I got.
Following this, I just wanted to pull David back slightly, just to touch again on that visit to Phnom Penh in 1981. Here, he begins speaking about Ben Kiernan, who at the time had, until recently, been a student of David's back in Melbourne. The conference that he speaks about in Chiang Mai, that brought together a handful of scholars who were writing about the recently defunct regime, and this conference and the papers that were written for it was later turned into a book. Historians such as Michael Vickery and Serge Tion were present, and although discussions of these somewhat controversial scholars didn't actually make it into the final cut of this interview, it is this small delegation, as David puts it, that were invited back into the country.
Ben and I edited that together. He was still a graduate student. I gave him a co-edit because he got some of these people on board, people I hadn't known. He knew that, you know, to get them. So it was good. And we were still, you know, pretty close, quite through his thesis, basically. Anyway, we came into Cambodia for 3 days with Michael and Ben and Serge and me and Chantoup, Ben's wife, five of us.
Mm-hmm.
4 days of Phnom Penh. It was quite spooky, but I was very interested.
Is that 81 or 82?
Yeah, 81. And yeah. There was still all money and blowing around in the street. And,
yeah.
The city was very, very strange. The hotel was pretty awful and so on. But
yeah.
It was just so a
three
glimpse.
3 days.
Oh, yeah, just 3 days.
And did glimpse, I imagine that was...
a glimpse of what was beginning to be PRK.
Were you sort of led around, or
pretty
were you
much.
Free to... Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah, just... Yeah.
They took you to the museum. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was the...
Nothing had a museum. No, nothing was stolen. Nothing was damaged. It was locked.
Oh, no, I mean, sorry, the Tuol Sleng.
We went to Tuol Sleng.
Yeah.
And, it was just about had opened. Pretty And we saw, you know, piles of stuff and junk. It hadn't been organized. The archives hadn't been organized yet.
Mm.
But that was pretty depressing. That was. But what there was at that time, and there was a solid silver head of Pol Pot.
You're right.
And guess where that went? Whoopsie daisy! Got that out of there pretty fast.
Where'd it go? Just took it.
Yeah. I mean, but it was one of the heads that they were making down in that.
Yeah.
It looked like silver to me, but I don't know what else it would be. It wasn't bronze.
Yeah.
And so there's some of these heads just around that the artistic team had made.
Yeah.
And so it's just, you know, 2 years later, you could almost smell it. It was so bad. So it was quite a catastrophic little visit, which was interesting. Then,
after speaking about actually going to S21 at such an early stage, I wanted to ask David about the place that this prison now holds in the overall perception of the Khmer Rouge regime. As the high school turned prison turned museum in Phnom Penh is now utterly synonymous with the Cambodian nightmare, I asked David, considering his book Voices from S21, how valuable the prison is as a resource for studying the Democratic Kampuchea government, and what the future of academic work might look like on this topic. Just for reference, Doik, the person Chandler refers to as Talkative, is the revolutionary alias of Kang Kek Iv, the former chief of the prison who was tried by the Khmer Rouge Tribunal in 2009.
Oh, I think it was enormous documentary evidence for one of the ruling sets of behavior of the DK government, which was to eliminate enemies of the state, eliminate traitors who are plotting against the state. Documentation, a lot of it is not factually true, a lot of it is just made up. So there's a masses of documentation to show you how the regime thought about itself and how it thought it should behave and who it thought it should go after. Now, it's the documentation that makes the place so interesting. And the There's also some other documents as well as the confessions, and there's also Dutt's extraordinary testimony at his trial and at his other interviews he conducted beforehand with journalists and so on. It's a very rich source of way to get into the Khmer Rouge regime, because Dutt himself is very talkative and the other guys aren't. They're either evasive or cowardly like his opponent, or just blank like Nguyen Chia. Just don't want to talk that much about it because, you know, I think he just sits there thinking, victory's justice. If I'd won, I would have done something else.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's...
So does that mean there's
I don't think there's much more that can be done with it. I mean, there is a book now coming out. I mean, not a book, a thesis is being written by this French scholar I mentioned before, Anne-Laure Pollet, who ran a blog all the way through the tribunal, and she was a journalist before on Cambodge soil, and so on. Very bright, intense, committed person, fluent in Khmer, and so on. And she's doing a book, which I think would be fascinating, of the actual life inside the prison of the people who lived there, and who they were, and what they did. And she just sent me a first chapter in draft, which is, it edited all this out, that is how the place was founded, how it was organized, who the people were, and why it was organized that way, where they came from. Fascinating.
Mm.
So I'm not claiming that my book is the only thing that should be written, but I don't think that other scholars are going to go into that archive. They can't go in there looking for facts, because they're not going to find them.
Mm.
Or they'll find some and they won't know. As Steve said at one point, some of the things sound true, but you can't. They don't have corroboration. They may not be true.
Mm.
And other things are completely cuckoo, like Vietnamese are digging tunnels all over Phnom Penh.
Mm.
I mean, well, there were the tunnels. Who'd you send them? Did you send them out to look for the tunnels?
Mm.
No, they wanted the person to confess this and then send it up to the headquarters.
Mm.
But there weren't any tunnels. So you can't use that as that's what I first thought. You could use it as a documentary history of opposition to the regime. Couldn't use it as that at all, because some of these people were falsely charged, but some of them were obviously traitors to Pol Pot.
Mm.
And that's his government, so he could decide who's a traitor. Doesn't mean that they're heroes or not. If they're traitors to his regime, they're people who tried to betray him. So there were some. But they're not going to be reread by anybody, I don't think. So I think that's done. And I think I don't know that much more work is going to be done on the Khmer Rouge period at all. And this is, again, an issue of academic life. There are people, there are no jobs available for people who specialize in China and Cambodia, or very few. It's not. Once you've done the biographies, once the books on the trial, some of them are quite interesting, but books about the conversion, I'd welcome them, but I don't think they're going to happen.
Mm.
And certainly not another one on S21, I don't think, except for Ann Law's book. So, I mean, you're sitting at a kind of a... And books are sort of disappearing anyway, as you know.
Yeah.
The kids don't read, the publishers don't publish. Da, da, da. It's a different world than it was 20 years ago. So there's not going to be more... So I don't think there'll be more books on the Khmer Rouge or fresh studies of it. I think the kind of work the DC CAM is doing about keeping awareness going, having museums opening up, having education programs. I just got a new thing just came in the other day about they're doing short histories of other mass killings. They're trying to call it mass killings, actually, not genocide.
Mm.
And I'm going to edit that a little bit, but I'm sure it's going to be fine. That's all to the good, but it's not the same thing as more academic work.
Okay. Just to sort of bring it slightly more contemporary.
Sure.
In the last decade or so, the Khmer Rouge Tribunal set up, actively began prosecuting surviving members of the regime. Now, in this time, you've provided testimony as an expert witness in two separate trials. The first was Case 001 against Doik. That was 2009. And you came back in 2012 in Case 002 against the surviving leaders, which mm-hmm. at the time was Nguyen Che, Yang Siri, and Khieu Sampan. So I'd love to get an impression of your experience testifying at the trial as an expert witness, as well as some of your ideas about the court in general. So first of all, I'd like to have you react to something that another prominent historian of Cambodia, Stephen Hedder, said when he testified at the trial in 2013. So he was being cross-examined.
Very cagey testimony. Oh,
yes.
Wow.
Yeah,
very,
really.
Very,
the footage of that is
very,
it's very interesting. Yeah.
No, go ahead.
So he's being cross-examined by the defense team of Nguyen Chea, and Mr. Hedder was asked why he was appearing at the trial as a witness rather than an expert witness. And here's just a part of what he said. So he said, "Most academics do not expose themselves to the situation where they express themselves to the record in a question and answer session. There is a process by which academics publish, reread their work. They run it by a friendly group of peers, and then they submit to a peer-reviewed journal. This is the right format for an academic to express him or herself, not in this question and answer format." So what do you make of that statement, and how do you reflect on your own experience at the tribunal in regards to this process of having academic works examined in a court format?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was just being spoken to at both those trials about my expertise. The first time it was not being called into question. Defense for the French man called Roux, a very eloquent, helpful, I thought helpful, quite interesting person, was just trying to get my views of my book, S21, my views of Deutsch and his responses to the book, which he enjoyed, which is interesting. But, you know, I just thought it was accurate enough for his point of view. So I thought that was very, very, I enjoyed that session. I'd never been in, my daughter lives in New York, was amazed I'd never been in court before. But of course I've never been in court before. I'm a law-abiding citizen.
That one was quite short, was it?
It was only one day.
One day.
So it was a very fruitful day, and I enjoyed it. So I didn't feel that a question-answer format was drawing on my work. That was the point. My published work. Different with Steve Hedder is a lot of his work is unpublished, and he also had worked very closely with the court itself, doing research that was not published. So he wasn't being able to talk about that. He was able to talk as a, I'm not sure how it worked out, because I mean, he wasn't really a survival witness of the Khmer Rouge like the others.
No, I think they picked him on, I guess he was there as a journalist.
He wasn't going to let them lead him down some path. And funny, he was a funny testimony. He worked very hard at the trial, worked like 10, 12 hours a day for months. With testimony and reading stuff and gathering stuff and going, he's a brilliant scholar and a wonderful, wonderful, committed to Cambodia. But yeah, I mean, the question and answer was, if it's about your published work, I think it's okay. But what he meant, it was about unpublished work or what you think. I think it's right. It doesn't advance the academic cause very much because you're working on how you defend yourself against charges about unpublished work, which they, you know, or personal items in your biography or something. The second time, when I was there for 5 days on the trial of the number two with the Nguyen Chea, Yang Siri, and Khieu Sampan, that was different because there were two, there's a real prosecution coming out very strong saying, you know, now we're going to hear an historian of the Khmer Rouge period that gave a chronological kind of sketch of what the history had been like and what had happened and what had caused various things on. And then I was attacked by the defense, sort of the defense, of Ian Suri, was the competent one. The other two defenses were not. Not very, I didn't think they were doing a very good job. But anyway, the Carnivas is a firebrand American lawyer who was, he wasn't saying that Yang Siri hadn't done some of these things or that the Khmer Rouge regime was a, but he was questioning the legitimacy of the court itself to get into this material. And I think it's very effective attacks all the time. not coming from a, he wasn't defending Hunsanner there, but he was just saying, you know, this is all a biased, which it was, of course. Victor's justice is the phrase he's used.
Yeah, there was a lot of, we want to put this on the record. And yeah, that being sort of,
that's right.
That was objected so to, but we want it on the record.
So his job with me was, but she went out with a certain amount of relish, and I thought it was kind of annoying, that it was to discredit my work as a historian, and he didn't manage to do it, and that was okay. But a bit of a waste of time, and of my time.
Yeah,
I mean, I enjoyed the whole thing. I think the thing, and I liked Justice Cartwright, the New Zealand. She was wonderful.
Yeah,
and she just asked very sensible questions. And one time, I could edit this out if you want, but one time I was saying something, and Cartwright asked, interjected some across, and I said, almost into the mic, I said, "Jesus, here he goes again." I said, she up her laughed. She heard me mutter this. She smiled and nodded or something. So she's my friend. It's okay. Yeah, I thought it was an enjoyable experience. It was, and in the evenings I was free, so I'd go out and see my friends and do different things. It was fun to do. Fun to be up there in that period.
Yeah.
So that was I was working with Sebastian Strangio. I was working on his book, starting that out. Mm-hmm. So I saw him a couple times and consulting with people, enjoying myself, was doing some work. That was the second time. But the trial itself, well, I think this blog I just wrote for, that I'll show you, I think there are three, I have a positive view about the tribunal now that it's over. Three positive elements. One is the generation of the vast amount of documentation, which will either be made available to the general public or not, but the fact is so much of it is out there already that people who have ever wanted to do a detailed history of the Khmer Rouge, now is that's the stuff to use, because their material, they were gathered for this trial that was never around before. And you get a really nuanced picture of the Khmer Rouge period from the documentation. The second thing is, it familiarized the over 100,000 Cambodians, I think 150,000, who came and visited the trial. And they came away, they'd been to see something, they'd seen the Khmer Rouge being discussed as a criminal enterprise by people who were trying to do their best to setting out the facts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they came home with some idea that there was some interesting work going on. The third thing is, a very simple anecdotal thing, is I as I wrote in my piece, is it discredited the Hun Sen adage of 1998 when Nguyen Chia and Khieu Samphan defected, to that we should dig a hole and bury the past.
Yeah, but
this did not dig a hole and bury the past. It allowed that, you know, so it contradicted that. So the three virtues I found of the tribunal. You could talk for a long time about, you know, administrative foul-ups, personnel mistakes, corruption of the Cambodian employees and so on, the indifference of the hostility, bordering on indifference of the Cambodian government. All those are, they're all negative factors. There are plenty of negative factors. It wasn't an unmixed blessing. But I think if you stand back from it, I think it's a good thing. It went on too long. They all do. They somehow they can't measure themselves inside a framework. The Yugoslavian one that went on for far too long. And all the information was there.
Still happening.
Yeah. And it finally got a couple of people locked up at last.
Next, I bring up what was, and perhaps still is, one of the bigger points of contention in the histories written about Cambodia. In the 4 years that democratic Kampuchea existed, the staggering loss of life in this period, this is often simply labeled the Cambodian genocide. However, the use of this legally defined term has been, in many cases, fairly liberally applied to this case study, and often in a politicized way. David talks about the definition of the word and how it's not really accurate to generally apply it to the events in Cambodia, as well as the other phrases that have been more or less invented to describe the actions of the Khmer Rouge.
In A History of Cambodia, you lay out the discussion between the variances between some academics and historians on the term genocide. So, you know, we have some people saying democide, autogenocide, it was crimes against humanity, or it was a quintessential example of genocide advanced by some people. So I would just like to know what you think the best way of describing the crimes of the Khmer Rouge are, whether this has changed over time, and why you think there is such variance between the interpretation.
I think crimes against humanity is strong enough to say what they did. You could also call them government-sponsored mass killings. This is what they were. This was the elimination of class enemies and the collateral damage, deaths that were caused, particularly among the millions of people who were not accustomed to the kind of work they were made to do. And this would be parallel with the Great Leap Forward in China, where people were just didn't know how to grow their own food, didn't know how to, and were overworked by the regime. So, genocide, by the UN definition, requires the elimination, whole or in part, of a group of people of ethnic identity. Now, this is almost 90%, I could say, I could guess the percentage, I'm not sure, of the victims of the, since they're only, no, since Cambodia, 85% ethnic Khmer. There's the Cham underneath, and also the Vietnamese and the Chinese and so on. It's about that same proportion of the victims of the Khmer Rouge regime, which didn't spare anybody. They didn't favor, they did not kill Chinese or not kill Cham or not kill. They didn't pick out, no, we're not going to do anything to you. Killed about the same proportion as the demography of the country in those days. 85% Khmer, I mean, ethnic Khmer. So then you have the Jean Lacouture, this trendy journalist, quite a good writer, done lots and lots of books, 3-volume biography of De Gaulle and so on, a very energetic guy. See, he invents this term, autogenocide. Well, what's that mean? It doesn't mean anything. But that's interesting, because it means suicide. And you can't say that the Cambodian DK government intended to eliminate in whole or in part the Cambodian ethnic.
They wanted more people.
No, there's no evidence that they wanted to. And I'll tell you another example I use when I give lectures on this was what it reminded me of my daughter in America. She's fine, she's a nice office job, but she's lived in New York for years, and she's been in a 7-Eleven holdup at least one, not only one, but they keep quiet and nothing will happen. And don't lunge, don't shout, don't get on your phone. That's what the Khmer Rouge said. You know, we're here doing a job.
Mm-hmm.
You just go about your business, you just get quiet.
Next, we discuss this theme of genocide in relation to other specific authors and historians who've covered the period. I start with Alex Hinton, who wrote Why Did They Kill in 2004, which was an attempt from a kind of anthropological angle to explain the mass killings. Eventually we talk about the theories of Ben Kiernan in relation to this. The blue scarves that I mention is picked up from Ben Kiernan's book The Pol Pot Regime, where he basically posits that a group of Khmer that were marked for execution were given these blue scarves, or kramar, as well as Steve Hedder's review of this book, which sort of debunked that particular story. We also speak specifically about the treatment of the Cham Muslim minority and the Vietnamese during the Democratic Kampuchea period, including Cambodian author Issa Osman's exaggerated statistics that were exposed during the Khmer Rouge Tribunal. and the wider reasons behind why the term genocide is used in this context. It should also be mentioned that I conducted this interview the day before the final judgment in case 002/2 against the surviving leaders of the Khmer Rouge, Nong Chea and Khieu Samphan.
I loved Hinton's book, Why Did They Kill? What do you think of that one?
I think he's pretty dogmatic. I mean, okay. he's a friend of mine. And he's been very good to me, good with me. But I think I don't think genocide happened. I think he got on the bandwagon too early. I just doesn't prove it.
Yeah.
And I thought the last book, the one about Dirt, was not good at all.
Okay, I haven't read that one yet. No, I was going to pick it up.
That's not the point, man or monster. I mean, you know, what Johnson, President Johnson said about Gerald Ford, said he can't walk and chew gum at the same time. But he walked and chewed gum at the same time, or the three or four things he was doing at the same time.
Mm.
He's a brilliant mathematician. He's sadistic.
Yeah.
You know, he's a great bureaucrat. You know, great bunch of stuff. He was all of those things at the same time.
Yeah.
And man or monster, I mean...
Too binary.
Much too binary. Now, why do they kill it? It's okay, but if you read it, you'll find there's only one source, and the source is this famous guy who's been overworked and overworked and overworked. He's the guy who used to take people out to Chiang Ek. You know his name.
Yeah.
The Vietnamese picked him out, and they put some people in jail for a little while. It's just been too bad. For him, they said, okay, their punishment is, you'll be the one that people can talk to. They hung him out to dry, basically.
Right.
And so he would talk a little bit, and then a little bit more, and then a little bit more, and a little bit more.
Yeah.
You know, and always... he's in Ritchie's film.
Yeah, he's the focus of...
I interviewed him myself. And so he was the one that Loom is called in Hinton's book.
They still trot him out.
It's the same guy.
Yeah.
One guy.
He's handing out books in high schools for DC Cam.
DC Cam isn't working. Yeah. Well, he needs the money. And
yeah, of course.
I think he has come up with a lot of regrets, deep regrets.
Mm.
But he came from no place, poor piss and so on.
Mm.
But what I'm thinking, you can't build a genocidal societal theory out of this one guy.
Okay.
And the reason was that Hinton was too early for Hinton to get a whole bunch of access. The government was there was still a lot of grenades around.
Yeah.
It seemed like he was mostly
out in.
It was early UNTAC, I think. Courageous guy. It was unsafe where he was, but he didn't. I mean, to my mind, I would not have reviewed the book, and Biden endorsed it, I think. But
I do believe you're on the front cover.
I think he knew what he wanted and didn't go looking for it.
Okay.
He made a decision that this is what it was. And there was a certain amount of small politics of this was the bandwagon to get onto. The genocide bandwagon. Is what he climbed on.
Yeah, he stretched the definition almost in the third page. He just
twists the definition out of
shape. What if it's this? And that's how we're going to talk about it.
What if it's not the UN definition? Well, then it's not the definition.
Okay. I mean,
when is a shoe not a shoe? Well,
it's
a sock. Well, that's not the shoe, is it?
Yeah.
But that was where people went because the Cambodians, particularly, because believing the Vietnamese mythology, That was what Cambodians wanted because it was so bad. When something BAD happens, it's that BAD. It's got to be genocide because that's all the BAD there is.
Mm.
No, there's lots of other BADs, and a lot of them actually turned to be quite closely linked to communism.
Mm.
But not all of them. Another one that's very closely linked is the Indonesian massacres of 65-6, where communism. This is a course I taught in America for several years. Government-sponsored mass killings and ages since World War II. Mouthful. I did about 15 students. I had a really good time with it.
Mm.
Did Vietnamese land reform, Great Leap Forward, Khmer Rouge, and the Indonesian killings.
Yeah. The Indonesian ones don't get mentioned too often. I wonder if you saw the documentary.
There are a lot of new books coming out about them.
Yeah.
And again, trying to twist the definition to make it genocide.
Yeah.
But when they're with their own people, and it can't. Anyway.
Well, that's I do have that question in there, but I sort of came to that as well. I had my own little where you read, and I imagine most people, they might pick up Kiernan's Pol Pot regime first, and you go, oh, the blue stars, this was genocide, and then you read some more nuanced takes. Philip Short's biography, I know you're an admirer of. Yeah, and his treatment of these are crimes against humanity. This is
right.
This is it. And I found that compelling.
And the blue scarves, anyway, if they're Khmer, they're not killed because they're Khmer.
Oh, yeah, Steve had killed that in his review.
They're killed because they're enemies of the state.
Yeah.
And this is a communist thing. They're the people that started with that wonderful French word, counter-revolutionary. They're the people that can change definition every day because you can always decide what the revolution is and anybody who doesn't agree with you, they're counter.
Yeah.
It goes back to Robespierre.
Yeah.
And it goes right on through the whole movement. But anyway, so that didn't work with Hinton. I mean, I'm just taking away from Hinton.
Yeah.
But it got funding for DC CAM because government-sponsored mass killings is too much of a mouthful. Genocide is so appealing.
Yes.
And it doesn't matter. I mean, the people are just as dead. As a matter of fact, in China, the Great Leap Forward, 20 million, that's a hell of a lot of people killed by mistake.
Yeah.
Or as collateral damage, is what I would say. Collateral damage to the policy that was made no sense. And the poor old Cambodians, of course, in that particular case, I mentioned it somewhere in my books, they thought it had succeeded. They thought the Great Leap Forward, because the Chinese they didn't admit until the mid-90s that it was just a colossal failure, which is why Mao was sidetracked and then had to recast himself to come back again with the Cultural Revolution to stir the country up, stir the soup up, make a big turmoil, have a big revolution again. But they knew he was responsible. He was edged off the center stage there after the reports all came in about how awful it was over the years. People melting down all their metal and not taking care of their crops.
Well, you hear the same sort of things, the isolated bits of cannibalism, that some of the more extreme the communist things, Cambodian ones.
A lot of good articles.
Yeah.
I mean, that... And,
on such a big scale.
Pol Pot was trying to do the same thing, but he didn't realize what had happened.
Yeah.
And so what happened was the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, he just ran in and everybody got killed. That's exactly what happened in China, but he didn't know that, which is it's the way those people behave with each other.
Yeah.
They don't admit failure. Anyway, so that was, the genocide thing just doesn't, and it's getting fading now.
What do you take on do you think the definition can be put on the CHAMs? For genocide?
No, because there's too many chams survive, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when you read genocide, eating pork and having your hair cut is not genocide. I mean, what's genocide is herding them into, which they didn't do, herding them into trucks and stuff and carting them off and not disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
A story, I've got a little thing I just wrote that I'll give you that went to a blog in Europe. Did you read the book by Thierry Cruvalier about called The Master of... it's wonderful. It's a French scholar, a friend of mine. Wrote a lovely book about Deutsch. Anyway, the point being... there's a book about them. Anne-Laure Poiret, the gal who was doing work, French woman who was doing work on S21. And she challenged one of these guys, when these guys at DC came and wrote this book about... And the statistics are all...
I know the guy.
So the statistics don't add up. They don't work.
Yeah, they said there's like a million chams.
No,
they said.
And he said,
yeah.
His answer was, it was all in a good cause.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a lie, but it was in a good cause.
Yeah, my interviewers, I basically told them what to say. And yeah.
So that was the cham. Now, the Vietnamese, it does work. And because in 78, the orders went out to kill the Vietnamese who were, I would say, uninformed enough to stay behind, I think probably because they were married to Cambodian.
Are we talking about how many people?
We don't know.
Less than...
This is the point. We don't know. But
okay.
There's enough that were killed because they were Vietnamese, and that's genocide.
Yeah.
And this is probably what the court is going to have a judgment tomorrow.
Tomorrow, yeah.
And my guess is they'll say genocide for both just to please the pressure they've been under.
Mm.
But they've avoided this for years. They've avoided the auto-genocide thing. They've been very, very... Because Hun Sen wouldn't mind if it was accused of genocide. He wouldn't mind.
No.
But it didn't work. It doesn't really fit.
It doesn't fit.
I was in DC CAM, what did this be, 20 years ago? No less than that. But anyway, there was a bunch of law students out for an American university, or two American universities.
Yeah.
Had law students out for their summer to work at DC camp, to border guards, do what you're doing. But you know, study what's going on. And they had a moot trial. Was it genocide or not? And there was an audience to vote on what to. And there were good law schools. There were law schools I heard of, like Northwestern and stuff. Mm-hmm. Good American law schools, not backwoods evangelistic or anything. These were pretty good, high-quality students. And how they came down with not is they couldn't prove intent.
Mm.
That's a key point.
Mm.
But with the Vietnamese, there's documentation saying, kill the Vietnamese, make sure Nguyen Chia and Hu Sinh would have known about it.
Mm-hmm.
So you could blame them for it if you want to blame them. But when I was there, that very summer, or was it later anyway, but the same issue came up. Again, American law students.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Ben Kennedy's book, he said 10,000. I said, as a student, I shouldn't point like that. And I didn't to her, but I said, research that figure. Where's he getting from?
Mm.
And she said, oh, that's interesting. I'll do that. I never got back to it. Probably couldn't find it.
Mm.
Because A, it wouldn't be documented. And B, I doubt very much of that when Vietnamese still in Cambodia in 78.
Yeah, well, you could just
get across the border and flee. They're all sent out in 75, 6. They had an agreement before they even started the war. The Vietnamese in Vietnam, South Vietnam, just become communist, come home.
Yeah.
And they said, okay, we don't know what's going to happen here, but we'll come home. And most of them left. They just left. And a lot of them came back.
And Lon Nol had been killing them as well.
He killed them in 70, 71, but a lot more in the countryside. So very few left behind.
Yeah.
And those were ones who were picked on. And Khmer Krom, they killed on two. They were sort of objectively Vietnamese.
Mm.
But that's genocide. So, okay, so that worked out.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend Sherry has just been writing me about this. He said, this is just the hubris of some of the international lawyers. Didn't want to participate in this thing without having a little bit of a genocide button in their lapel.
Right.
What do you mean it wasn't genocide? You didn't do your homework.
It's called the Cambodian genocide, right?
No, it's called the Cambodian genocide. It doesn't really matter that much.
Fit.
But I still think I'm right, which is always good to think that.
Yeah.
I mean, I just on the intent issue.
Yeah.
And also because I don't think actually the genocide is the very worst thing that can happen. The very worst thing that can happen is any of those things are all.
Yeah.
The very worst thing can happen as soon as they start.
Yeah.
You have genocide in Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia. You have it in Rwanda. You have it in Southwest Africa, the Germans in 1914, where they tried to wipe out some tribe. A lot of stuff. It exists.
Yeah.
And that's over here. That's when they do that. Then you have going after all your own people, which is China and Vietnam and Russia and Indonesia.
Mm.
The four that I taught. I mean, there are probably other ones you could find that would work out. But mass killing of your own people for some cause or just to wipe them out because they're in the way of what you want to do. That's what happened. A lot of people were died by accident. They just faded or they died their diseases or whatever. But yeah, so I think it's mass crime against humanity, a thoughtlessness of immense proportions. Nobody seemed to care very much that all these people were dying. Nobody seemed to mind that was happening. And none of the people in charge expressed any regrets at all that stuff happening. The closest you get is Hu Sinh Pao saying he didn't know about it, which is crap. Of course he knew about it. But genocide, it's a very appealing term to use for people to use or to choose to use, decide to use when something very bad has happened. Very bad, or bad, as kids say sometimes, very bad. And why can't it be, the Cambodians say, why can't it be genocide? It's just as bad as the other genocide. All these hundreds of thousands of dead people. The government's connected to it. Hitler, Pol Pot, Nazi, but they don't think those things through. But sticking to the definition, I don't think is doing any harm to anybody, and it's certainly not disrespecting in any sense at all the victims of the Khmer Rouge. It's not making them less meaningful or whatever. But if you decide to go the genocide route, and it means changing the definition of the term to suit yourself. And you can't do that. I mean, I think the man who did it, I forget his name, the famous lawyer who invented the term.
It's eluding me at the moment.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If he were still alive, he could have, I should probably, but he did try to change it. Back in the 1940s, they tried to put through the UN that if the political elimination event, the Russians, who had in the meantime won World War II, which they did, or won Europe in Europe by defeating the German army, refused for obvious reasons because they'd done that. And they were not going to do that. So it was not admitted. And so some people drag it out. But he originally intended. Yeah, he originally intended, but it didn't happen. So it did, what happened was what he wanted to do, but it wasn't become a law. It didn't become, didn't go through the UN.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's all the thunder and lightning stopped. People aren't going to be excited about it anymore. But be interesting what they come out, the court comes up with when they come with their judgment tomorrow, whether they will decide. If they're only saying that indicting for genocide against the Cham Muslim minority population and the Vietnamese minority population. Now they have several choices. One is to say genocide didn't occur in either of those places, in one of those places, in both of those places, none, all, or some. My guess is, under pressure from all kinds of people who've been funding a trial and so on, because they seriously believe that what happened to Cambodia was so bad, you have to call it genocide. That's basically what it boils down to. They will nod to those people and say, yes, this is what happened to those two minorities. And that's it.
And then label somewhere near.
Onto the minorities. But they've avoided auto-genocide, which makes no, the concept makes no sense.
Yeah.
There's never been a regime in, do you remember this mad Protestant minister called James Jones?
Of course.
There it is. He intended to eliminate all his followers, including himself.
Yeah.
Now, that's not auto-genocide. That's auto-genocide. That's an example. It has happened. But that's the only one I can think of. Several thousand people in the late 80s. That's right.
Yeah.
I mean,
had their own little country go there, at least a town.
It has happened, but to have a national policy is absurd. It strikes me as absurd. So, any more?
If you wanted to talk about any new books or articles you're working on at the moment, if you want to talk about that.
What I'm working on now is quite different from nothing. I mean, it's about the British Gurkha colonel who accepted the surrender of the Japanese in Cambodia in 1945. And that's a kind of much more British history with a certain Cambodian chapter in there. That's what I worked on at the moment. I'll send you this blog thing, which says a lot of things that I said today.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'll just, for the sake of recording, I will say... Thank you so much for inviting me into your home today and sharing your time with me, David, because it's been an absolute pleasure.
You're most welcome.
All right.
So there you have it. That was Professor David Chandler. The second fascinating interview we've had from the Chandler family on this podcast. David's books are usually prominently displayed in any bookstore that might have a section on Southeast Asian history, so please check those out if you want to read one of his excellent works on Cambodia or the Khmer Rouge. feel free to go to www.shadowsofutopia.com for more information about this podcast or myself. And thank you very much for listening. Until next time.